Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the Riptide. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Howdy, hey, howdy.
Ah, John, you troublemaker. You just trying to throw me off, aren't you?
Just gotta change it up once in a while, you know. Love variety. Can't do it the same way all the time.
Sure. I guess that's the way it is for you. I've been just like a one-legged man in the ass kicking contest. It's been crazy.
Lots of work up there in the Bay Area.
Yeah, it's, you know, all the pandemic changes. Everything's changing. Every day, everything's changing. Now we can't get cans. We can't get CO2. We can't, you know. Right. There's too many problems.
Yeah, I can see that.
But, you know, here I get a chance to sit with you for an hour or two. And,
a beer.
Seeing you makes me happy.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Even pandemic distance still makes me happy. And you know who else makes me happy?
Our good friend John Blickman, I would imagine.
There you go. And not just because he pays for this show, so all you listening don't have to. It's because he's actually a genius engineering mind that has dedicated his life to making your brew day, that much more innovative and easy. And fun, and check them out, blickmanengineering.com. If you get a chance, look at all the neat stuff they have there, and send an email to my good friend John Blickman at feedback@blickmanengineering.com. Tell John how much you appreciate that he's paid for the show, so you don't have to. So that's the least you could do for me today. Our guest today is Martin Cornell. He is an 8-time winner of the British Guild of Beer Writers Award and one of the UK's most read beer bloggers. He has written about beer, food, travel, and the history of beer for newspapers and magazines around the world. His book, Amber, Gold, and Black, is regarded as the definitive history of British beer styles. And Martin's currently finishing up a 3-year project on kind of the history and the fascinating stories of porter as a beer style across the world. And so we thought it'd be kind of a fun thing to get him here and speak with us about porter. How are you doing, Martin?
Oh, I'm doing well, thank you. Yes, it's a pleasure to be here. It wasn't meant to be a 3-year project, but it just grew and grew. You know, it turns out that there is just so much to say about porter as the world's first global beer style, the first style to not only be drunk in dozens of countries around the world, but to be brewed in dozens of countries around the world as well. And I think people have perhaps forgotten or never knew just how popular porter used to be.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. We never planned on this being a 16-year show, did we?
That's right.
so there you go. That time sneaks up on you. Well, and porter was, you know, one of the first industrial beer. Is that correct? You know, mass produced beer.
It turned out once they started making the beer that it was actually very suitable for producing on a much larger scale than they've been able to do before. It was a very robust beer. And as I'm sure you know, and I'm sure a lot of the people can watching and listening know, for a long time before the invention of cooling technologies, it was impossible to brew successfully from about the end of April right through till really September or even the end of September. So they had to brew strong beers in March, strong beers in October to last that gap. Porter, they found, because probably of the brown malts that went into it, because of the greater quantities of hops that went into it, you were able to brew it for a longer time period. You could go right through till May. You could begin again at the beginning of September. This was an advantage immediately for the porter brewers. Also, you could brew it in larger vessels. And this was also important for scaling up, because again, before cooling technology, the larger the vessel, the hotter the fermentation got. With porter, again, because it was a much more robust beer, you could use larger vessels, and you got all the economies of scale and so on. So the porter brewers found that they were able to grow larger than the ale and the ordinary beer brewers before them were able to do, and these economies of scale eventually meant that the porter brewers just outpaced everybody else.
When the whole story of how porter started, now there was always the story of Ralph Harwood in 1722, making a beer called Entire. It was the Three Threads, and this was the start of porter. And how true is any of that?
Ralph Harwood, yes. When I first started researching this stuff, I'd read all the books, and they all said Ralph Harwood, blah, blah, as you say, 1722. And I thought, right, okay, well, let's try to find actual evidence for this happening. When did it happen? Let's find out more about it. But the more I researched it, the more I was unable to find anything from the time period, from the early 18th century, that confirmed that this story was true. And it turns out that what seems to have happened, it was that in 1802, in other words, 80 years after the events supposedly being described, a journalist called John Feltham wrote a story in which he got a bit confused about the references to Three Threads, which was a thing. Three Threads was a thing at the beginning of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. He got confused with one or two mentions about Ralph Harwood, who was a brewer in Shoreditch on the edge of London, but not a very big brewer. He was about the 20th largest brewer in London at that time, and London had probably 80 or 100 big and small brewers. So Ralph Harwood was certainly, he brewed porter, but he wasn't one of the major players at all. Feltham managed to get hold of a few bits of information and basically invent the story that porter, which is also known as entire butt, and we'll come back to the reasons for that later on, I'm sure. Porter, he decided, was a replacement for this beer that had existed called Three Threads. Wrote this story, as is the way with 18th century journalism. This was immediately plagiarized and repeated by literally dozens of other publications across Britain and eventually around the world, repeated hundreds and hundreds of times. And because nobody ever challenged it, nobody ever attempted to find out if there was any actual basis for this story, it became the accepted story behind the invention of porter. And I think one of the reasons was that people like the idea of the hero who comes up with the answer to a problem. You know, supposedly the story that Feltham put up was that three threads required serving from three different casks, and this man called Ralph Harwood solved the problem of the poor old landlord having to rush backwards and forwards from tap to tap by combining it all in one cask, and this was the entire butt. Unfortunately, that's all complete nonsense. What Three Threads actually was a tax fiddle. back in the early 19th century, of course, they had no way of measuring the strength of beer to tax it. So they did it on the price of the beer. Beer under a certain price was taxed as small beer, and it paid, I can't remember exactly how much, but something like, let's say, sixpence a barrel, a cask. Strong beer, which they defined as having a retail value of, I think, over 6 shillings a barrel, that paid 1 and 6 pence tax, 1 shilling and 6 pence. But because they didn't know how to measure or couldn't successfully measure what strong or what weak was, there was the possibility of brewing extra strong beer, and that would only pay the tax on strong beer. What landlords and brewers started doing was brewing extra strong beer, which only paid the tax, the same tax as strong beer, and then mixing that with the small beer, which had paid less tax. They now had 2 barrels of beer the same strength as strong, extra strong, yeah, and the small mixed together. You've got two barrels of strong, which had only paid the total tax of 1 strong and 1 weak. I hope you're following me, and I'm not.
Yeah.
So it was all illegal, of course. You know, the law stopped this happening, or supposed to stop this happening. But that was what Three Threads was. It was a mixture of very strong beer and weak beer sold as strong beer in order to try to not pay as much tax as they were meant to. Had nothing at all to do with porter. Porter has a completely different set of origins. Porter began as London Brown Beer, which was one of the big sellers at the time.
And what year was that?
And that was, London Brown Beer was through from probably the arrival of hopped beer in this country, which is, you know, the 15th century, when immigrants from Europe bought the use of hops. Previously, we'd had ale, which originally meant unhopped beer, maybe flavoured with other things, maybe not. You know, it's quite unclear. But I'll try not to lose the plot by talking about that. So, hop beer came in. It was brown. It was fairly lightly hopped. It was probably quite strong, 7%, perhaps something on that sort of order. And this ran through quite happily until the end of the 17th century, when the government was looking for ways to raise revenue. We were involved with a lot of wars in Britain at that time, fighting the French, fighting in Ireland, fighting in North America, a war I believe you guys called King William's War. And the government needed to raise money to pay for this. So they started putting taxes up on beer itself, and also on malt and on hops. So what the brewers did to try to keep their beer affordable, they did what brewers always do, they lowered the strength. Two problems with that. One problem is that if you lower the strength, then the beer is likely to go off more quickly. So they therefore increased the amount of hops in the beer.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing that they did was to start using cheaper malt. And the cheapest malt was wood-dried malt. Problem with wood-dried malt is that it's very smoky. You know, it's Rauch beer, basically.
Right.
So to try to get rid of the smoky flavours, they stored the beer longer, because over 6 months, 9 months, the smoky, the very strong smoke taste will slowly disappear. And they were able to do this because they were hopping it more anyway, so they just up the hops, and that way the beer would keep even longer until the smoky flavours had reduced, certainly, if not totally vanished. What they didn't know what was going to happen next, but what happened next over the period that they were storing it, of course, and again, they knew nothing about this, Brettanomyces, which was ubiquitous in wooden brewing vessels and storage vats and so on. Brettanomyces comes out of the wood and starts munching away at all the higher sugars and so on in the beer, producing all these lovely estery flavours. At the same time, because you've now got a very well-hopped brew, you're not getting the sorts of Lactobacillus and Pediococcus organisms that you do in, for example, lambic, those sorts of Belgian sour beers. Right. So you were ending up at the after the storage period when the beer went on sale, you now had a beer that was beautifully smooth, lots of lovely estuary flavors to it, all entirely unplanned, but proved an enormous hit.
Right.
And it was an enormous hit with the working men of London, basically. And these guys, many of them worked carrying goods on and off ships, carrying goods around the streets, taking parcels hither and thither, carrying packages. And these people were known as porters. And they were organized by the City of London authorities into two separate types. There were the fellowship porters, who did the carrying on and off board ships, and the street porters, or ticket porters. They needed an awful lot of calories to keep them going. It was hard work, it was strenuous work. They needed lots of energy to carry on doing this. And one of the ways that they got their energy was by drinking on the job.
Well, that's why I drink on the job.
Absolutely. So they drank a lot of beer while they were working. They were notorious for it. And it was 6, 7, 8 pints a day these guys were drinking.
Wow.
Not to get themselves drunk, but to just get the calories to be able to do their tough, hard jobs. So it started out that they gradually were storing this beer longer and longer in butts, which is the size of cask, 3 times a barrel, if I'm remembering correctly, which is 108 gallons. Storing these for 9 months and up to a year, gradually they learned that if they stored it longer and longer, the beer got better and better. So this was originally known as butt beer, because it was stored in butts. But gradually it got the name of the people that were its biggest fans, porters. The name slowly changed from being referred to as butt beer to being referred to as porter. So I hope that has given you a sufficient explanation there. Right.
Let's take a short break. Yeah. And when we come back, I want to hear more about how porter developed. We'll be back right after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Are you looking for a simple brewing system that's great for all grain brewing, but everything on the market seems to be full of compromises? Blickman Engineering has the answer. The Blickman Brew Easy All Grain Brewing System. The Brew Easy is a complete system with easy upgrades and a beautiful compact design, perfect for any size brewing location. At its core, the Brew Easy is built on 2 gorgeous Blickman Boilermaker brew kettles, a high temperature March pump, and either a top tier gas burner or the new boil coil electric heater. The Brew Easy adapter lid allows the pots to stack on top of each other, forming an efficient, strong, and compact brewing setup that comes in 5, 10, and 20-gallon batch sizes. Upgrade your BrewEasy system with full automated control by adding a Blickman Tower of Power temp controller, and make moving around easy with the Blickman Kettle Cart. The BrewEasy is modular. If you already own a Boilermaker kettle, you can build your BrewEasy by purchasing just the modules you need. The new BrewEasy all-grain brewing system. See it today at BlickmanEngineering.com and brew with Blickman quality on your new BrewEasy. Easy.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking with Martin Cornell about the history of porter, and he's been researching porter for the last 3 years, and probably, you know, before that too, you learned a lot about porter. And you were talking about how they were storing the beer in butts for 9 months, a year, and the beer improved because of the Brettanomyces.
Yeah.
But you know, I've also heard these stories of the large large vats in London, and then the staves giving way and drowning people in the streets. And what about those stories?
Well, the problem with storing it in butts is that you needed a lot of cellars to store this beer in. And it was also expensive in terms of
cooperage.
Having the butts built by the coopers in the first place and maintaining them, and they had constant problems that people were stealing the butts, cutting them in half and using them as flower planters and all sorts of other things. And it was actually quite dangerous. There are stories of people going down into the cellars where these butts were sitting, and of course there's fermentation going on, and again they didn't know what was happening, but these butts, of course, were these cellars were filling up with CO2, carbon dioxide. People were going in there and collapsing. Other people were going in there to try to rescue them, collapsing as well. People were dying in these cellars sometimes. So nobody's exactly sure when it started happening, but people worked out that maybe it was better, rather than having all these butts lying around in these cellars. And I think they were paying a shilling a butt a year to lease out cellars around the City of London. Maybe it was better to start building large vats. So they started off building vats that were 150 barrel size, and gradually as the vat builders' technology got better, so the vats got larger and larger. But they did have a series of unfortunate accidents. The famous one, of course, was the Great Flood of London in 1814, but there have been quite a few over the years before that. There was one in Whitbread's Brewery on the edge of the City of London, where apparently they drowned hundreds of rats when the vat burst and flooded into the cellars, and pulling out dead rats for an extended period afterwards. So they were pushing the envelope as far as the technology was concerned, and it eventually ended in dramatic fashion, of course, with the Great London Beer Flood. And that wasn't even one of the biggest vats. That was a 3,000 barrel vat, I think, at that particular brewery called Mewkes's, M-E-U-X, Mewkes, Mr. Mewkes. It was one of the smaller vats in the brewery. They had 20,000 barrel vats. But that kind of put an end to the fashion of building bigger and bigger vats. I mean, it was a bit, if I may use the expression, it was a bit willy waving, really. My vat is bigger than your vat.
Right.
Oh, fantastic. And also, one of the fascinating things about porter is the way that tastes changed. The public's taste for a long time was for well-aged porter. Gradually, in fact, by the time of the Great London Beer Flood, tastes were moving away to what was known as mild porter, which was mild meaning young, unaged. The aged porter was called stale in the terminology of the time, which is not stale as we use the word today. It just meant it stood; it had been standing around, and it had got all those lovely estery, slightly tart flavors.
From the Brettanomyces. Yeah,
indeed. And the mild porter was a lot sweeter, not a lot sweeter, but certainly sweeter. Gradually over the, as the 18th century wore on, whereas previously, around about the 1740s, they were tended to be drinking all stale porter, aged anything up to a couple of years. They started mixing the mild, the young porter, fresh porter, with the older porter.
Okay.
And so by the time you get into the 19th century, you would still be able to go into a public house and you would order porter, and they would be able to pour it from two different pumps, one stale, one mild. And you would say, draw it mild or draw it stale or whatever was your preference. And again, by that time, because slowly people were turning away from the very strong, very tart flavours. And why? There's a you know, a subject that I could spend hours debating why tastes in beer change, but I don't think we'll ever know why. And eventually, by the end of the 19th century, you start reading about them pulling down these huge vats out of the breweries and recycling them into bars in pubs. So somewhere, perhaps even now, there are bars in pubs that are built out of recycled old porter vats. I don't know. I've always wanted to see if it's possible to start drilling into a few old pub bars. Yeah. See if we can identify them. Dendrochronology, I believe is the expression.
Well, and one thing I love about your writing and the work you do, you really dig into what was the truth. You know, a lot of these stories that we get are just that, stories, and the truth is somewhere, you know, in between all the stories, and you dig in and you actually research and have proof as to why something actually happened, you know, the way that you write about it, which I really love. And I got to also give you kudos for your Strange Tales of Ale, which is one of my favorite books. I love that book. I think everyone that's interested in beer and the, you know, just kind of the stories and history of beer ought to get themselves a copy. I think you can pick it up off Amazon pretty cheap in the US. So
my career has been as a journalist, and I like the stories. You know, I like telling the stories, and there are some fantastic stories around, and there are stories that turn out to be true that everybody didn't think was true. One of the ones in Strange Tales of Ale, we're getting completely off the subject of porter for a moment, is about the IPA shipwreck. Mm-hmm. The story was that IPA was introduced into Britain. It had only been a beer sold in India, but it was introduced in Britain after a ship was wrecked in a storm, and the insurance companies salvaged some of the beer and put it on sale in Liverpool, and everybody said, "Well, this is great, we want more of this," and that started a market for IPA in England as opposed to in India. And nobody had been able to find the story of this wreck, and everybody said, "Oh, this is just a myth, it didn't happen." Now, the great thing about being a researcher today with the internet is the number of newspapers that are now out there, the old newspapers that have been scanned, it is unbelievable. In fact, there's far too much information out there. But it does mean that you can actually track these stories down. And I was looking for something else, and found this magazine where this guy actually talks about this incident. Now, the book that it is reported in said that it happened in 1827, if I remember correctly. So everybody had been looking around that kind of period for this supposed shipwreck and been unable to find it. This obscure magazine article, which somebody had scanned in and put on the web, said that it had happened in 1839 and gave the name of the ship, the Crusader. And so given those two clues, and given the fact that there are now thousands and thousands of newspapers scanned, it took about half an hour to find newspaper reports of, yes, this ship genuinely had gone down in a famous storm in 1839, one of the most violent storms ever to hit British Isles. It had been wrecked off the coast of Blackpool, which is in just north of Liverpool. The crew had all escaped, but the barrels, and it even named the brewers, Bass and Allsop, two very famous Burton-on-Trent IPA brewers. The barrels had washed up and down the coast. Indeed, they had been salvaged, and the newspapers actually carried the reports of the sale of these barrels of IPA. So yes, this story that everybody thought was a myth was actually true, and we could now, thanks to the internet and thanks to all the hard work that libraries and other people have put into scanning all these newspapers, we can now actually point to this. And the same is true with a lot of the stuff in the porter book that I simply would not have all these great stories that I'm finding without the fact that you can now find all these newspapers on the web.
So you mentioned, the London Brown beer, and up until a certain date, porter was, a paler version than we see today. Today with black patent malt, the invent of the patent malt, it became darker.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems that they had, technologically speaking, was that around about the 1780s, they started using the saccharometer to measure how much fermentable material they were getting out of their malt. And at that point, they realized that the brown malt that they were using, 100% brown malt, diastatic brown malt, so something that we really don't have today, and we're not even certain how to make, although people have, of course, started trying to make diastatic brown malt. Diastatic brown malt is very bad because you don't get a lot of fermentable material out of it compared to pale malt. The porter brewers were always under enormous pressure to keep costs down and to sell their beer as cheaply as possible. And every time they tried to put the price of a pint or a quart of porter up, there were literally riots on the street and people protesting outside brewers' homes and so on. So they realized that it would be a lot cheaper to brew the beer with pale malt because they would get much better extract out of it. But then, of course, they'd lose the color. It wouldn't be the dark color that people wanted. I was probably descriptions seemed to hint that it wasn't the complete black beer that we know today. It was certainly very dark brown. But they talk about it being made transparent. Well, that suggests, because to begin with, it wasn't transparent. And gradually, as they learned to age it more and to use isinglass, it became transparent. Well, that is a hint that you could actually see through it. It wasn't totally black. But even so, people expected their porter to be very dark. So if you brew a beer with quantities of pale malt, obviously it's not going to be as dark. So they needed to find ways of making a dark beer, but by still using as much pale malt as they could get away with. The problem they had was that the tax authorities would not let them put anything into beer that had not been taxed. So they couldn't use burnt sugar or anything like that. They had a great deal of difficulty persuading the tax authorities to actually let them use roast malt. They couldn't use roast barley because that hadn't been taxed. Eventually, a man called Daniel Wheeler invented a way of roasting malt upon which the tax had been paid, so that was fine, and producing an extract that you then only had to use, I think they started off using 5%. You could actually get as low as 2% of this roasted malt in a completely otherwise pale malt beer. So unfortunately for him, he then lost the case when he tried to protect his patent. And although people carried on calling it patent malt, he didn't have a patent on it. And so he didn't make the money, obviously, that he was expecting to. But from that point on, from 1817 on, you start to see increasing use of this roast malt. There was a split, interestingly, between practice in Ireland, where they almost all Irish brewers, if not all Irish brewers, and certainly Guinness, went over to using 98% pale malt and 2% roast malt. In Britain, and certainly in London, the brewers liked to use at least a certain quantity, 10, 15, maybe even 20, of brown or amber malt, because they felt it gave a better flavour. So then that's where you start to see a difference between Irish-style porters and stouts and British-style porters and stouts.
All right, let's take one more short break, and when we come back, I want to hear more about Ireland and how, is porter and stout the same thing, or are they really different? We'll be back right after this.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking the history of porters and around the world. We haven't gotten around the world yet, but we've gotten down to Ireland. And, you know, one of the questions I always get from people is, well, what's the difference between porter and stout? And, you know, you make up some sort of, differentiation. And generally, I think, porters tend to, have a different character than a lot of the, especially the dry stouts. Back in time, it was Irish brewers were brewing porter, and then they just started saying, well, I have a stout porter. I have an extra porter. And then it became like an extra stout. And it was just kind of a marketing thing to say, to call your beer stout, because it sounds more impressive than porter.
Originally, I mean, the only difference originally was that stout simply meant strong. Mm-hmm. It was a stronger version. And originally, you didn't have to even be brown or a porter or black. You would get pale stout, and pale stout was a thing. Certainly, as late as the 1840s, you get mentions of pale stout. Brewers in London were brewing pale stout, and the stronger versions of porter were brown stout, and that was what they were called. But if you read the descriptions of brewers talking about the beers, they use strong porter and brown stout more or less interchangeably. You know, there was no real distinct difference between, where a porter turned into a stout, apart from around about, maybe 7 or 8%, you start calling it a stout porter. Mm-hmm. And gradually the porter bit got left off. And so it was just stout. But to begin with, they were exactly the same beer, except that one was stronger than the other. And they were normally brewed from exactly the same grain bill, exactly the same hop bill. And you might even get, off the same mash, off the same quantity of grain, your first mash would be the stout porter. Your next one would be your ordinary porter, and then you'd have probably the last washings you would recycle back into the next mash, which was not an uncommon thing for people to be doing then. So it was stout and porter, exactly the same beer. Gradually through the 19th century, you start to see stouts being brewed on their own, and there was a tendency for stouts to become a little sweeter. And you then get this whole divergence into milk stouts and other sweeter forms of stout. But in Ireland, certainly, but they never really went particularly for the sweet styles of stout. Then you do have these dry stouts. But Guinness internally just called its beers porter and extra porter for a long time, and that, as far as they were concerned, they were all porters, and it was only, indeed, for marketing purposes that they called it stout and extra stout and foreign extra stout. And the only difference between the extra stout and the foreign extra stout was that the foreign extra stout had more hops in because it was going abroad to hotter climes, and therefore it needed to have more hops in to preserve it.
Now, Martin, I have a question. At this point in time, was the beer still being aged for a long period, or they had stopped that, say, in, a period before?
By probably the 1850s, you're now getting what was called running porter, which was okay. very fresh, very... sent out quite quickly, and at the same time you were getting the aged stouts.
Okay.
So yes, you start to see a split between the aged stuff and the fresher stuff, because people were, as far as most people were concerned, they didn't want these very heavy, very strong tasting beers anymore. Some people did. So there was a market for the aged stouts. People were much more into running porters, porters that were served up very quickly.
Yeah, because my impressions of the brown malt porters were I've brewed with brown malt, and it is a very dry, astringent flavor, very strong. That would take time to precipitate out and mellow. I know my own effort did. And so when they started switching from the brown malt to the pale malt because of the invention of the saccharimeter, so I guess that was sort of this transition from the brown malts and the long aging to mellow the beer to the pale malts and the ability to serve younger beers. And then, as you say, with the invention of the patent roast malt, that facilitated that transition as well. So I guess, so this was the period of time where we're seeing both a procedural or an industrial transformation of the beer, as well as a change in the style.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of the fascinating things I think about porter is that if anybody says, I want to brew an authentic porter, you have to say, right, well, when do you want to be authentic to? Of history would you like to be authentic to? Because it's changed. You know, we think of it as like, you know, porter is porter. It's changed half a dozen at least different times down the years.
Fascinating.
Well, it seems to me like a lot of the change to porter was really just financially driven. The change in the malts, the change in aging. You know, aging a beer is expensive. You know, it requires, you know, storage, and, you know, you've locked up your materials for a long time. Yeah. So, and you get obvious losses when you age a beer. So I think a lot of the history of porter is just driven by, you know, economics.
Yeah. Well, this, of course, was one of the barriers to entry for smaller brewers, that they couldn't afford to tie up this capital in aging the beer for a couple of years. And it's why the London porter brewers, porter brewing became restricted to 6-8 or so really, really big companies, which came to dominate the market. And then a whole mass of other much smaller brewers below them. And it wasn't until brewing technologies, there was still, although I think at its height, porter was about 80% of the London beer market. Gradually, that started to fall away as people's tastes changed, or not so much people's tastes changing as porter drinkers dying and not being replaced by new cohorts of porter drinkers. The new drinkers that were coming in were drinking different sorts of beers, and they were drinking mild ale. Quite fresh, still quite strong. And gradually, at the same time, what was happening was that technology was catching up so that you could brew these mild ales on the same sorts of scale that the porter brewers had been able to brew their beers. So the London mild ale brewers had all been very much smaller than the porter brewers. The porter brewers were getting up to 200,000 barrels a year each, you know, which for the time was enormous. These were the guys for the biggest brewers in the world. The ale brewers were tenths of the size, 20,000 barrels or so on. Suddenly in the 19th century, as taste change and ale becomes more popular and as technology enables the ale brewers to brew on the same sort of scale as the porter brewers had, you see the ale brewers suddenly gain on in terms of size, gaining rapidly on the porter brewers. And by the 1860s or so, names that have been, you know, well down the rankings when they were ale brewers are now as big as the big London porter brewers. It's this mystery. Why do people's tastes change? We don't know, but they do. And one of the fascinating things about that is every single style of beer has always been replaced eventually by another style of beer. So you saw porter. I'm talking about Britain specifically here, but it's true in other countries as well. You see porter replaced by mild beer. You saw mild beer in Britain replaced by bitter. And then you saw bitter replaced by lager. What's going to replace lager? People are starting to talk about IPAs. And I would not be at all surprised if we see eventually the 90 or 100 year rule of big lager finally succumb to a new type of beer, because it's happened to every other dominant type of beer. You know, again, this is one of the fascinating things about porter is seeing it decline and then surge back up again.
Right.
If porter declined when it was such a massive, huge force in the market, why should the same not happen to lager? I don't know.
Well, and did porter really decline, or did we just start calling it stout more?
That's again an interesting question. In Britain and in Ireland, one of the problems again was that strength started to fall, partly initially in the 19th century to try to keep the beer cheap. And then in Britain, we had the First World War. World War One came along. Taxes soared enormously. They went up from about less than £1 a barrel to £5, £10, £15 a barrel. This again has previously put pressure on brewers to try to keep the beer affordable. So strengths plunged. And what had porter had been before the First World War in Britain, been around about 5.5-6% alcohol. End of the First World War, it was down to 3-3.5%. Stout had gone down as well, but stout was now the same strength that porter had been. So if you wanted that same experience, you now drank stout rather than porter. And porter was very much an old man's drink. It was, you know, literally dying on its feet. And it finally, I think the last porter in Britain, it still kept on in Ireland, where it was drunk by shipyard workers who just came off shift and wanted something to wash the dust from their throats and to refresh themselves. In Britain, the last porter was brewed in the early years of the Second World War and then just vanished after 250 years. So yes, it's true that porter was replaced by stout, but as far as being Britain's favourite beer was concerned, it was replaced by mild ale. Mild ale was the dominant working class beer in Britain. In America, interestingly, there was not this replacement of porter by stout. There seem to be very few, from what I've been able to find, very few beers called stout brewed in the States. It was almost called porter. It was very regionally popular in certainly in and around Pennsylvania and in New York and in New England. But after when everything came back and restarted after Prohibition, there were still a lot of porters being brewed. Very few stouts. But of course, nobody had drunk a porter. There were a few, Yingling produced something called Porto or something like that during Prohibition. So, you know, there was kind of near beer style porters. But basically, nobody had drunk a porter for 13 years. So anybody under 30 or 31 never had this beer. Well, and certainly not legally, and probably not at all. So you've got a whole like missing cohort of people who are not used to this strong black beer. Mm-hmm. So trying to sell them a stout, you know, an even stronger, even full of flavour beer, wasn't going to work. So you start to see quite a lot of porters in the 30s and then really diving down until probably by the 50s, very few porters. And I think through to the 70s, there were maybe about four mm-hmm. porters still being brewed. There was Darren Gansett, was still going in Rhode Island. It was Yuengling and Stegmeier, and I think there might have been one other, but that was it. And I don't think any stouts at all. So we there was a difference in the way that it develops in the British Isles, where, yes, porter more or less gave way to stout. And in the States, where porter just vanished and stout never really took its place.
And was porter, you know, one of the first beers being brewed in the United States?
No, I don't think similar. Yeah, the first porter brewer that I've been able to find in the States was a guy in of all places, Virginia. He was a plantation owner, Irish plantation owner, who was he was losing money on his plantation, and he decided that he would start brewing porter. This was the 1760s. Previous to that, there had been quite a lot of brewers, but they'd all been brewing ales, and they'd relied for the porter on imports because it was still felt at that time that, you know, only London could brew porter and only Thames water. You know, there was this myth of the idea that only Thames water could make decent porter, although in fact probably a minority of brewers were using Thames water to make porter. So for a long time it was felt that you couldn't brew decent porter in America until this guy had a go. Wasn't very successful. Eventually his brewery collapsed. And that was at the end of the 1760s. Then along came, of course, famously, Robert Hare, whose father had been or was a porter brewer in London, in a place called Limehouse, which is by the Thames. He had been exporting his beers to America, sent his son out with a recipe book and I think £1,500. And he was thinking about settling in New York, but eventually settled in Philadelphia, built himself a brewery there, and was almost immediately very successful. And of course, famously, George Washington was a big fan of his porters. Washington had been previously importing porter from London, and by the 1770s, you start to get porter appearing in Bristol as well, so imports from Bristol.
I want to tell you all about my good friends at Brew Chatter, brewchatter.com. They're out in Sparks, Nevada, right near Reno, and they've signed on as to help, pay for this show so you don't have to, and you can check out their stuff. If you want to brew a great porter, I know my friends RJ and Josh at Brew Chatter. They have all the ingredients. They have everything you need. They have all the knowledge. They can help you out producing a great porter. So if you want to make a porter of whatever history types of in history, they could help you do that, including aging it with Brett in a wooden vessel. They could do that too. One more short break, and we'll be back right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
Okay, we're back. We're talking porters with Martin, and a couple of things. I follow your blog. I follow your Twitter and all this stuff. And your blog, you actually it'll email out all your latest postings, and there. Again, they're very detailed. You know, it's a history lesson about, you know, something in particular. It's a very nice read. Where do people go to find more about your writings and your books?
If I can give myself a plug, you can find my blog at zythophile, zythophile, .co.uk. That's the blog. I try to put something up at least twice a month, but they tend to be, I do it entirely wrong. You're not meant to put long form essays on a blog. Mm-hmm. I can't help myself. They all end up over 2000 words. Once I get started, it just goes on and on. And they do, I have to say, they do take a lot of research. So that's why I don't do them more often. And I don't. I do it in part to get the story straight in my own head. It's not so much. I mean, I'm glad that people enjoy reading them, but I don't really do it so much for the audience. It's for me. It's all being done for me. The books are available on Amazon. I think about the only one is Strange Tale of the Veil, which is a collection of past blogs like the flying beer in Spitfire drop tanks to the Normandy beaches and stories like that. You can only the book I'm most proud of so far is called Amber, Gold and Black, which is the history of British beer styles, and that is now out of print, although you can still get the Kindle version. So it's still available on Kindle, and I'm surprised that came out in 2010, and I'm surprised. I was having a look at it, it's still stands up historically quite well, although plenty of things have changed. You know, I just fitted in a brief history mention of barrel aging, which was barely a thing in 2010, and similarly the IPA chapter stops before massive expansion of different styles of IPA that we've seen recently.
Someone, the friend of mine asked me. He said, "Oh, you know, he was reading something about how Jim Cook from Boston Beer invented barrel aging beer," and I was thinking about that, and you know, like, well, beer's been barrel aged for a long time. You know, I mean, we see with the story of porter. Do you have a sense of, you know, did people back then only use new barrels lined in pitch, or did they, you know, ever reuse, you know, whiskey barrels or wine barrels?
No, I think they tried. British brewers certainly tried to get as little barrel character into their beers as possible. They would buy oak, what they call Memel oak, which came from the Baltic, what is now, I think, modern Lithuania, which is very tight-grained oak, so that you would get very little oak character coming out of it. This is we're running out of time. We barely even talked about it. One of the reasons why you got Baltic porters is because the brewers were exporting their beer to the Baltic, so that they could bring back this oak from the Baltic and also the iron to make the hoops with, and also the isinglass, which came from Russian sturgeon fish. So they didn't pitch. I've seen no references to using pitch, but they certainly wanted no oak character at all in their beers. So aging it the way that people do now, in terms to actually in getting actual character from the barrel, is a very new thing. It's a terrific thing, you know. We're seeing all sorts of wonderful new styles and so on develop. The only people who were happy to get that sort of character out were the Scotch whiskey distillers who liked to buy, as you probably know, buy old sherry barrels, and they were getting some of the sherry character out. But beer brewers, certainly in Britain, would try to avoid anything to do with that. But wasn't anything that they wanted at all.
It's just fascinating, you know, your knowledge of the history of beer and porter. And one question I got to ask you, what is one of your favorite beers to enjoy now? What styles of beers are you mainly enjoying?
I'd like to say that if you've got a favorite style of beer, you don't really like beer. It depends where you are, what you're doing, and so on. Right now, because it's quite cold, it's suddenly got very cold and damp in Britain, and it's time again to drink dark ales. We have a lovely tradition in this country of what we call winter warmers. dark, quite, you know, quite a lot of brewing sugars in there, full of fruity flavors, 6, 7, 8%. And they're just great for sitting around a fire and sipping gently. So that's at the moment, those are the beers that I'm particularly enjoying. But I, you know, I drink, if I'm at a hot Greek beach, I'll drink a pale lager. You know, the same with everybody else. You know, wherever you are,
depends on the situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go. Well, thank you for joining us. It's been an absolute joy. Next time I'm out in the UK, I'm going to let you know, and hopefully we can get together and have a pint.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, please do. Please do. And thank you very much for letting me rabbit on for an hour.
It was our pleasure. Yeah. Great show.
Everybody else has
all right. Thank you, and thank you to our fine sponsors. Check out Blickman Engineering, blickmanengineering.com. Innovating Your Brew Day. Check out Brew Chatter, our good friends RJ and Josh at Brew Chatter, a great homebrew supply shop that can help you craft a great porter, great whatever beer. If you're listening live, stay tuned. John and I will do a show, a Q&A show, answering your questions live on whatever brew topic you might have. Thanks again, Martin, and we will see you all next time. Until then, everyone, brew strong.
Brew strong, everyone.